Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thank you so much, Mark, for your kind introduction. It's always a bit bizarre to have your biography read back to you. I would like to extend my sincere thanks to the organizers for putting together this very rich conference and also for their unparalleled hospitality. Thank you, Morten. So it's wonderful to be here, even on a Sunday morning. I confess that the change to winter time came as a very pleasant and much-needed surprise. I would also like to apologize for depriving you of the effective aesthetics of my PowerPoint, which is non-existent. But if you feel too bored by my presentation, you can just enjoy this image, which I think is also relevant to what I'm going to talk about. So I've been fascinated by the topic of distribution and exercise of power in, over, and through international criminal justice for a number of years now. International justice, in fact, is all about the assertion, deployment, delegation, and contestation of power. And as any other lawyer, I'd typically look at this through the lens of legal institutional competence, be it about the division of labor between courts, be it about tensions between courts and other actors, or the court's procedural operation. But to understand how power is exercised as opposed to ought to be exercised, and I acknowledge that we often conflate these notions, any lawyer would normally reach for statutes, rules of procedure and evidence, regulations, and we tend to rely on our neat organigrams to learn about the institutional setup and the structures of authority in which power is asserted, utilized, and held to account. But this is why we are getting it wrong all the time. Formalism simply entraps us in a sort of epistemic bubble, but the reality is a multivariate mess. The tools that we use to chart the power dynamics and predict the outcomes of discretionary decision-making simply don't capture that complexity. Often we fail to explain why power holders choose to act in a certain way or not. Power relations are overdetermined by contingencies and context, at least as much as by normative and institutional frameworks. So the sociology of law can help us grapple with the blind spots left by legal formalism and help us grasp better the status and transformations of power relations. The socio-legal approach draws the praxis of international criminal law as a web of interactions between institutions, collectivities, and individuals who advance, channel, counter, and coalesce around power claims in different fora and at different levels. So these agents are guided by their own mandates and professional roles, as well as personal interests, and their conduct is invariably shaped by prevailing socio-political and material conditions. So this perspective has been marginal in ICL, but it has been picking up, fortunately, in recent years, and I think there is no better way to rejuvenate our discipline than opening it up for sociological expertise and methodology. Sociology can give rise to the more incisive and empirically grounded critiques of ICL norms, institutions, and practices. It therefore also has a considerable reformative potential. We just need to get out of this cozy bubble of ours. So the tribunals were traditionally seen as agents and conduits of power, and almost never as its objects. But given the focus of this panel, I would like to shift focus away from courts as power holders and to the agents which wield power vis-a-vis the tribunals themselves. And here I am particularly interested in the political administrative entities which states create to perform governance tasks in international criminal justice, or the so-called international judicial governance institutions, also known by the abbreviation which was coined by my colleague Niels Blocker, INJUGOVINS, so International Judicial Governance Institutions. I'll be using this term a lot, so please try to remember it. There is a lack of socio-legal knowledge about the organization, processes, and practices of INJUGOVINS, And it is quite paradoxical, because they are, in fact, the centerpieces of the power structures in ICL. And this inattention obscures the root causes of the tribunal's perceived failures and their reduced efficiency and legitimacy. I dare to submit that most of the political, operational, and financial handicaps that plague the courts that we all love are in fact rooted in the underperformance of Injugovins. It is all the more important to apportion blame accurately at the time when courts are facing with an avalanche of legitimacy critiques. So what failures are the courts own, and which failures are in fact attributable to the governance institutions? I think we'll be calling many things by their name had we recognized the tribunal's handicaps primarily as governance problems. And governance failures are plenty. They take the form of less than methodical enforcement, inability to provide strategic guidance to the courts, and encroachment on judicial independence. So this is the question of power, after all, because on the one end of the spectrum, we have failures to exercise power properly and in a timely manner, or even at all. And on the other hand, we have more or less flagrant abuses of power. So I do think that Injugovins are important power holders in international criminal justice. Why am I saying that? Well, it's simply enough to mention some of their prerogatives and powers. They adopt and amend the tribunal's constituent documents and secondary legislation. They shape and reform the court's institutional structures. They decide and allocate the court's yearly budgets. They elect the tribunal's highest officials, judges, prosecutors, registrars. They exercise management oversight in relation to non-judicial aspects. They guarantee enforcement and implement tribunal's decisions. Obviously, if Injugovins don't perform these critical functions properly, then the tribunal's work will be derailed. And I'll say more about this problem after sketching some of the main governance models that have been in use, in order to give you a sense how power is channeled in each of those models. So Injugovins come in different colors and shapes. The governance arrangements have varied by tribunal. There are almost as many governance models as there have been courts or families of courts. So let's look at the main models. Some courts are embedded or enveloped in a parent international organization, whose organs then are tasked with governing the tribunals. This is the case with the ad hoc tribunals and the MICT, which are the subsidiary organs of the Security Council. So under this model, judicial governance functions are distributed among UN organs, broadly corresponding to their usual functions in the system. The General Assembly elects judges from the list submitted by the Security Council, approves budget, which is prepared by the Assembly's Fifth Committee. The Secretary General nominates the prosecutor for appointment by the Security Council and appoints OTP staff on the prosecutor's recommendation. Security Council's legislative role is to adopt and amend statutes and enact other resolutions, for example, triggering institutional reforms for the completion of the mandates. The Council also introduced the Institute of Ad Litem Judges and prescribed deadlines by which the tribunals were supposed to wrap up their judicial work. But other than adopting the statute, the Council was not legislating on criminal procedure. To ensure judicial independence, this task was reserved for the judges, who exercised it very actively, especially at the ICTY. In general, the Council did take all the necessary institutional measures without fail, but its track record as enforcer was arguably less impressive, because requests to tackle non-cooperation by regional states were often met with silence. Then the oversight was performed normally by the Office of Internal Oversight Services and its internal audit division under the Secretary General. And the Assembly occasionally used special arrangements to ensure oversight. For example, in 1998, it requested the Secretary General to appoint an expert group to review an effective operation and functioning of the tribunals. So I call this a bureaucratic or envelope model of governance, because ad hocs were enveloped in a larger organization and governance functions were exercised by its organs. So let's move on to the next model, the diplomatic model. The example is, of course, the Assembly of States Parties of the ICC. Unlike the court, the ASP is not an international organization, but a treaty body. So the ASP provides management oversight regarding the administration of the court, it decides the budget, it is also a forum for electing judges, prosecutors, deputy prosecutors. The ASP adopts and amends the rules of procedure and evidence. Judges may only adopt provisional rules in urgent cases to be applied until the ASP acts upon them, if it acts at all. So in principle, the jure, the ASP, is the primary procedural legislator in this model. The ASP also considers the court's referrals in the matter of non-cooperation by states parties. But in situations referred to the court by the Security Council, the Council acts as a co-governing body for the limited purpose of enforcement. I call this a diplomatic model because the ICC is governed multilaterally by states parties through regular diplomatic conferences, and there is only a thin bureaucratic superstructure, so ASP presidency and bureau. The third model that I would like to identify is managerial or executive, and that's the case with hybrid tribunals, the Special Court for Sierra Leone, the Residual Court, STL and the ECCC. So they have been administered jointly by the United Nations organs or assistance missions and judicial administration structures of the respective states. But importantly, these courts are funded through voluntary contributions, and each has a management committee composed of major donor states, which play a crucial role in running these courts. That's why I refer to this model as the managerial or executive model of governance. All these modern approaches, in fact, grew out of the primal scheme, which I call a direct governance model. The elements of that model can be found at Nuremberg. At Nuremberg, there was a strong element of direct governance by the four allied powers, who appointed judges and their alternates and prosecutors. The London Agreement and the IMT Charter did envisage a degree of institutionalization because governance functions were also assigned to the Allied Control Council, which was the supreme authority in matters affecting Germany as a whole. So the council was dealing with matters concerning the execution of sentences, for example, and budgetary issues. But its bureaucratic structures and practices were really primitive and improvised. Well, some matters were also delegated to the military, so they were the competence of the Allied powers directly. The execution of death sentences, imprisonment, detention pending execution were all assigned to the quadripartite commission of military commanders appointed by each zone commander and the Allied Kommandatura of Berlin. So here the institutional veil was remarkably thin. The Council was little more than a sum of the four powers constituting it, which is why I think we can speak of a direct governance model here. So these models that I have identified, bureaucratic, diplomatic, managerial, and direct, show the spectrum of possibilities, but they do not exhaust that spectrum. The models are not sealed off, there are commonalities as well. I'm not saying that under a diplomatic model there is no bureaucracy or that direct governance elements are alien to the executive model. On the contrary, a diplomatic model based in Jugovin can grow overly bureaucratized in some respects, as happened with the ASP, for example. And direct governance elements can infiltrate bureaucratic and managerial models. So the general trend is a move from a more direct governance by states towards greater institutionalization. And this is evidenced by the increasingly sophisticated superstructures and thicker institutional veil. So in Jugovin's own agency becomes more than just an aggregate of wills of its members. But even as part of collective governing entities or bodies, individual states continue to play a crucial role, even if a less direct one. The power dynamics change, But individual agency is not cancelled, because power can be exercised within the Injugovin or outside of it through an external actor. So this is what some states have done in the past. For example, Kenya attempted to make waves and rock the ICC boat by channeling its grievances through the African Union rather than only through the ASP. So as with many things ICC, its governance schemes may appear to be superior to anything else. No. In the time remaining, I will try to show you that the ASP is not a dream in Jugovin. In fact, it has let the court down too many times. I don't mean to excuse the ICC for any shortcomings of its own, but I think it's also fair that states parties should bear their part of responsibility rather than be allowed to shift blame to the faulty ICC all the time. So let's take a hard look at the Injugovins as well. Governance of courts is a delicate balancing act everywhere. On the one hand, there is a need to guarantee their judicial independence, but on the other, courts must also remain accountable. So risks of mismanagement, inefficiency, and abuse should be minimized as much as possible. And any such incidents should be properly and fully investigated and acted upon by the Injugovin. So finding the right balance between judicial independence and effective governance in respect of international courts in particular presents special challenges. First, the concentration of legislative and executive powers in one body is not unusual here. Take the Security Council or the Assembly of States Parties, for example. Second, the tribunals operate in highly politicized environments and they are dependent on the goodwill of other actors for nearly everything, for the exercise of the most basic judicial functions. So this increases risks for judicial independence. States can exploit their position in governing bodies for political purposes, such as to influence cases in which they may have a direct interest, and this has happened in the past. But an important counterpoint is that we all have learned by now that the tribunals are not immune to mismanagement, corruption, incompetence. Their efficient and accountable operation must be ensured at all times. So competent and hands-on governance is crucial. And a judiciary will instinctively resist, with reference to judicial independence, any externally imposed governance measures perceived as too intrusive. But not every such judicial complaint should be taken on its face value, because legitimate governance concerns may also warrant putting additional checks and balances in place. Still, the executive should take care not to interfere in the exercise of court judicial mandates or be seen as micromanaging courts, because this is inappropriate. This is a bottom line, but drawing it is easier said than done. So judging by the ASP's track record in running the ICC, claiming that its governance schemes are optimal would be too generous, to put it mildly. The ICC's Injugovin has managed to skew the balance both ways at different times. On the one hand, the ASP is an amorphous, lukewarm, incompetent, and lingering Injugovin, responsible for serious governance gaps that undermine the ICC seriously. But on the other hand, it also came too close to endangering judicial independence. So let me give you just a few examples. Everyone has read about the recent revelations by the European Investigative Collaborations Network, so it's unnecessary to restate them here. But if the alleged facts are confirmed, what we have in our hands is basically a huge bouquet of procedural violations and breaches of the code of conduct by the former prosecutor and serving OTP staff. Earlier this month, Prosecutor Bensouda announced that the matter was being investigated by the internal oversight mechanism, and the two staff members concerned had been suspended. And you may wonder what all this has got to do with governance. Well, everything, I would say. Even if I leave to one side the fact that state parties have missed the mark back in 2003 when they unknowingly or knowingly elected as a prosecutor a person who fell short of the Article 42, Paragraph 3 requirements. which is a governance issue. But one problem acknowledged by the court recently is that when Ocampo was still in office, there was no financial disclosure system in place requiring senior management to submit an annual disclosure of asset form. So the court was simply not aware of Ocampo's private financial arrangements. The system was only introduced in 2015, 13 years after the court's establishment. The question begs itself, why so late? A similar question arises with regard to the internal oversight mechanism. It is an operationally independent office reporting to the ASP president and competent to investigate reports of misconduct by elected officials and court personnel. So the IOM became fully operational only in 2017, when its inspection and evaluative functions were finalized. The IOM is now seized with aspects of Ocampo Gate and has competence over serving, but not former OTP members. Ocampo cannot be subject to disciplinary sanctions, let alone removal, it's too late. But the failure to establish IOM prior to 2009 and to agree on the parameters of its investigative mandate until 2013 reveals a serious accountability gap in the OTP in the earlier years. So the reason it took so long to operationalize the IOM's investigative mandate is that the former prosecutor himself was strongly opposed to extending the powers of the IOM to the OTP staff. The OTP argued that such a power would encroach upon the prosecutor's independence. So it's only after Ocampo left in 2013 that a compromise was reached, which means that the compromise was possible in principle. This is where the ASP must have been much more proactive and firm. It must have insisted on the soonest operationalization of IOM and on extending its investigative function to the OTP as well. Management oversight and accountability should not be a mere afterthought, but rather an important priority in the setting up stage if we are really serious about risk management and about avoiding governance gaps. So another example, lack of enforcement, which is as problematic. It concerns the Assembly of States Parties' unwillingness or inability to address States Parties' non-compliance with the court's requests for cooperation. This is in fact a dramatic governance failure which undermines the integrity of the system as a whole. So in July 2017, the pretrial chamber found that by not arresting al-Bashir while he was on South African territory in June 2015, the country neglected its cooperation duties, preventing the court from exercising its functions. So when deciding whether to refer this matter to the ASP and Security Council in accordance with Article 87, paragraph 7, the chamber controversially but understandably regarded this to be unnecessary. Engaging external actors would, in its view, not be an effective way to obtain cooperation. So this obiter dictum is revealing because the chamber observed that States Parties had been referred to the ASP and council 6 times for their failure to arrest and surrender al-Bashir. And the past 24 meetings of the council following the adoption of the Darfur referral resolution had resulted in nothing. Proposals to develop non-cooperation referral follow-up mechanisms were not taken up by the Security Council, and this further strengthened the chamber's belief that a referral of South Africa was not warranted as a way to obtain cooperation. That's basically another way of saying, dear ASP and dear Security Council, you are totally useless. The fact that the pretrial chamber saw no point in the referral and said so is a serious rebuke to the governance bodies. It must be a wake-up call, but has it been heard? Well, I go Dante here. Abandon hope, all ye who enter here. On the other end of the spectrum, we have instances when the ASP proved careless enough to intrude in pending judicial matters. The exercise of legislative function proved problematic to the extent that it compromised judicial independence and muddied waters in the ongoing cases. Before 2013, all rule amendments were developed in consultation between the ICC and the ASP's study group on governance. Agreement was to have a structured dialogue between the court and the ASP in line with a special protocol, or roadmap on the review of rule amendment proposals. But in 2013, the 12th Assembly session adopted rules 134 bis, ter, and quater concerning presence of accused at trial. And it did so on its own, entirely. The roadmap was circumvented, although it was actually meant to prevent a disparate and unstructured process of reviewing rule amendment proposals. The court was simply put before the fact, hey, we're adopting these rules. These amendments were in fact propelled by Kenya on the eve of the Kenyatta and Ruto trials. States parties thought that adopting those rules would diffuse tensions with the African Union and succumbed to pressure of some delegations. Rule 134 quater in particular allowed excusal from presence at trial for persons exercising extraordinary duties at the highest national level. The problem with this rule was that it was tailor-made to the then ongoing cases. It was more liberal than the existing appellate jurisprudence, which also provided for an exceptional circumstances requirement, but that requirement was dropped from the text of the rule. Besides creating a conflicting interpretation of Article 63, paragraph 1 of the Rome Statute, the ASP's intervention served to signal to the court in which direction the ASP expected it to go. Even if the following decision to excuse Ruto from presence at trial was not influenced by the fear of backlash from the ASP, from the African Union, the perception is that it could. And this is already an affront to judicial independence. Another example is the ASP's weak response to the pressure by Kenya during the 14th session in November 2015. ASP was dragged into the unholy business of molding the court's application of amended Rule 68 regarding the admission of written evidence of unavailable witnesses. So Kenya wanted to suppress incriminating evidence of witnesses who recanted or disappeared. And that evidence had been admitted by the trial chamber in Ruto and Sang. The issue was then pending before the appeals chamber. Kenya lobbied other states' parties to ensure that the rule amendment could not be applied retroactively in the Ruto case. It requested to add this item to the agenda of the 14th session, and the ICC principals wrote a strongly worded letter to ASP president, reminding him of the principles of judicial and prosecutorial independence, separation of powers, especially that the same issue was sub judice. The topic of retroactivity of Rule 68 completely dominated that ASP session, and not much else was done. The diplomats were simply too busy discussing this whole issue. Kenya's oversized delegation breached all diplomatic conventions and the decorum of a multilateral conference. They blackmailed other delegations and threatened the members of civil society with retaliation. The head of the delegation berated other states' parties for a range of sins, from anti-African bias to the lack of intellectual honesty. Other delegations were deeply upset by this behavior, but continued to work behind the closed doors. In the end, states' parties refused to settle the issue by an official resolution. The compromise language was put in the official records of the conference, reproducing the text of the resolution that originally amended Rule 68, and also referring to Article 51, paragraph 4 of the statute. The language was relatively innocuous, but the Kenyan delegation could then present it as a major diplomatic victory back home. So what happened at the 14th session set a really dangerous precedent, in my view. The Njugovin overstepped its mandate and interfered into matters sub judice, so much for the judicial independence. Even if it was not the reason why evidence was ultimately suppressed and the Ruto case collapsed, the observer can simply connect the dots, namely the ASP's attempt at substantively influencing adjudication and the ultimate case outcome, the case collapsed. So these examples show the worst of both worlds, an underperforming Njugovin that in occasional fits of activity when political stakes are high, crosses the red line. So this raises the question of obligations of governance institutions vis-a-vis their courts and the question of accountability. Who watches the watchers? So can this problem be fixed? I hope so, but we really need to make sense of what is happening empirically. We should go beyond the consideration of legal norms and institutional mandates. The Rome Statute system is still new and constitutional practice is immature. The terms on which the SP may govern ICC are yet to be defined with precision. Power struggles and frictions are unavoidable. So how can the SP be a better in Jugovin? First of all, states parties should come to terms with the fact that consensus is not always forthcoming, while certain decisions have to be made. Decision making can be made more swift and constructive if issues are submitted for vote. States in minority may be displeased, but that's the price they have to pay in the collective decision-making body. States should also take their obligations towards the court more seriously. They must respect and protect independence without taking the hand away from the pulse of the court. They should counter all attempts to hijack ASP sessions with the purpose of taming the judiciary, while essential governance matters remain neglected. Third, it is evident, and that's the last point, that the ASP Bureau has really limited resources and its staff are overwhelmed. Many states' parties also lack in-house expertise and experience. They cannot afford being involved in all governance matters. On the more technical issues of procedure, they have insufficient understanding and are unable to offer strategic guidance to the court. They may be better off outsourcing substantive analysis and teaming up with external specialists. The work done in between ASP sessions must become more expert-driven because governance powers should come with competence and accountability. Well, this won't solve all the governance problems, but at least this might give us some leads. Thank you for your patience, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.